How I Did It, the Business Post Women in Leadership podcast.
Sponsored by Glamdoor, creating space for business to grow.
Hello and welcome to How I Did It, the Business Post Women in Leadership podcast series with myself, Nadina Regan. This is a series where we talk to women at the forefront of their professions. We also get advice for your life from experts in areas such as public speaking, networking, career management and more. Later on in this episode, I'll be joined by Valeria Aquino, Integration Officer at the Immigrant Council of Ireland. She'll be discussing how to make your workplace more inclusive. First, though, I'm delighted to tell you that our guests on this episode of How I Did It are two women who've been responsible for creative, progressive work on stage and through the screen that has encouraged different ways of thinking in Ireland. Activist and arts worker Sarah Durkin is Associate Director of Science Gallery International. She has served on the board of the Abbey Theatre and is on the advisory panel of Dublin City Council's Culture Company. She was a lead organiser of the Waking the Feminist campaign to achieve gender equality in Irish theatre. From Castlebar originally, she also ran for a Dáil seat in the recent Dublin Bay South by-election as a Social Democrats candidate. Linda Cullen is CEO of Coco Content, the production company behind TV shows including Room to Improve with Dermot Bannon, First Dates Ireland and Generation Dating. She has been directing, writing and producing programmes since the mid-80s, and her own credits include co-directing The 34th, the story of marriage equality in Ireland. In the interview you're about to hear, Linda and Sarah talk about how far we've come as a country, but also about how much further there is to go. Do women still fight for gender equality in our theatres? Is a kind of sexism still at play in the workplace? What about our policies around maternity leave? And how long does it take to institute real change? All that and more is explored. And we have a bit of crack too. And so without further ado, this is Linda Cullen's and Sarah Durkin's How I Did It.
How I Did It, the Business Post's Women in Leadership podcast.
Linda and Sarah, you're both very welcome to How I Did It. How are you?
Great, thank you.
Very good.
Now, impressive CVs from you both, it has to be said. But before we talk about your trajectory, can we chat a little bit to start about the grim, grim previous 2 years? Because for people in the creative industries, it has been a tumultuous time. And Linda, to start with you, TV productions. With the best will in the world, with the best team in the world, TV productions stalled. Everything stopped. Nobody could figure out how to safely make, whether it was TV, drama, films. So the results were presumably quite seismic. How did you experience it?
So when the pandemic arrived here, we were in the middle of making Dermot Bannon's Incredible Homes, a series that involves a considerable amount of travel. I'd had to make the decision to cancel the Japan trip the previous month. And we were about to go to Spain, and then the announcements were made. Now, we were obviously in production with other things as well, but they were in Ireland. So, yeah, you have to just stop. We just downed tools. Everyone went home. We all went up to the office. We took our computers with us. People took chairs and we just left. And then it took a number of months to really figure out. And that was just figuring out with people in RTE and my colleagues, how do we do things safely? And I suppose we just had to observe, you know, what the restrictions were and how could we possibly ever do things safely again. And actually we found that we could. So there were a few months of, I mean, like everyone had, really kind of slightly terrifying. I kind of presumed the business would go. I thought that would be the end of that because...
And that's 60 odd people, right?
Well, yeah, at the time we probably did have around 60 people. We don't have people full-time employed, but from a freelance perspective we'd have upwards of 60 people at any given time. So, you know, the industry is quite a thriving industry, but it's independent. It's not, you don't have any security really. So if you don't have any productions, you don't have any income, so you can't function. So I really did think that the company wouldn't be able to survive. For about 4 to 6 months, I felt that that was a likely outcome.
Wow. Sleepless nights.
A lot of sleepless nights, yeah. A lot of upset. But then, of course, you have personal upset too, and you've all the things going on, and the kids were home from school, and we were trying to manage that as a family at home. And yeah, it was just really, really difficult. And that whole thing, I'd never worked from home before. I was always a mom who went out to work, you know. So working from home was really quite challenging. In many ways, it was lovely. But when the kids are at home as well, it becomes really, really difficult. So in some ways it was gorgeous. I had lovely time. Myself and my wife had great times with our kids. But then it was scary because I didn't know if we had any work.
Mm. And Sarah, how was it for you? What was your experience like?
Well, like Linda, travel stopped immediately. We were due to go to Atlanta. We'd just been in London for the opening in Science Gallery London of Genders. Travel just stopped immediately. And we worked from home straight away. We were used to working remotely, so Zoom wasn't much of a mystery to us at that stage. And all of our galleries had to shut, those who were running public programming. Thankfully, most of them were able to move to online programming. And actually, in many ways, it was really successful and brought lots of new people into science galleries. And we were able to run a global youth symposium last January, entirely online, 700 people. We'll run the next one, which will be a hybrid event in July. So it has been challenging times for universities, which are our members in the Science Gallery Network. But there have been some upsides as well in drawing the network together and working collaboratively. Mm. Certainly for colleagues who've worked in theatre and in my previous life, it's been very, very challenging the last couple of years.
And people will know Science Gallery itself shut in January. What was that experience like?
Well, that's very difficult. Obviously, Science Gallery is the first one that generated this entire network of 8 galleries around the world. We're very hopeful of working with Trinity to ensure that we can reimagine that in the coming months, and hopefully it will reopen.
It's just a time, I guess, of tumultuous change. And Linda, actually, it occurred to me that given that you got your start in the 80s, I think I'm right in saying you left school at 16 to ply your trade.
Well, I think I just left school at 16. Yeah.
But you're no stranger to tough times, because the 80s was a period of recession, of challenge, and definitely not really an era of what one would think of as TV in a big way,
no,
because it was still two-channel land for quite a lot of homes through Ireland.
No, so, I mean, I left school at 16. I did very badly at school. I wasn't a school kid as such, if you get me. And there was nothing, it wasn't really possible for my family for me to go to third level. I wouldn't have gotten the results anyway. So I was out to work, you know, very young, I suppose. Well, young in these days, not young in those days, really. I mean, I was a picture framer for a while. I did a few things before. And then I did, neither of you will remember Anko, I don't think. Okay, a nod. We're giving our age away there.
What was Anko?
It's pre-FOSS. Do you remember FOSS?
I know, I think I absolutely remember FOSS. I know FOSS.
Yeah. So Anko was that kind of state body that, you know, helped people do these courses, basically. So I did a course in car communications on media studies after I'd been working in an office and working as a picture framer. I was about 18 or 19, I think, and I did that course. And from there, kind of took off. Now, not you don't land in telly land from an Anko course, but actually I learnt an awful lot of practical skills. And I had a bit of a, you know, I had a bit of a propensity for some of it as well. You know, I was good with the camera. I liked production. I liked solving problems. I liked pictures. I liked sound. So it was sort of, it was one of those things that you just, it's a bit like recently I started playing tennis. Sorry, I digress, but I kind of feel like I found God. I never played tennis before. So when I did my Anko course and was making videos in car communications, it was a bit like that. It was like, oh my God,
light bulb.
I love this.
Yeah.
So I'm a bit like that about tennis now.
Okay. Unexpected. But what was it like actually being a woman in that industry? Because I would imagine it was male dominated.
Yeah, but I mean, it is only a reflection of what everything was like for women then in the workplace, I believe. It wasn't any different to any other. So yes, there was lots and lots of discrimination. And yes, there was plenty of harassment. You know, that was kind of the norm in the 80s and 90s. So we sort of all just, I remember me and my friends, you know, were of similar age. You just sort of bizarrely accepted it. You just kind of went, well, that's what the way it is. And you have to work your way around that. You know, as a kind of younger woman, I would have been straight, frankly. And then as I became lesbian, I don't know kind of how to explain all that. But anyway, so as a young straight woman, you know, there was plenty of instances of older men in positions of power, making inappropriate advances to me and to others, and physical advances, not just, you know, oh, I think he has a bit of a twinkle in his eye for me, like very, very direct. And you, as I said, you had to move your way around those things because you would have just lost that work or you wouldn't be able to continue on. Mm. I also then had very straightforward things. I worked with a guy, a fantastic cameraman called Peter Robertson, who got so frustrated on my behalf at the amount of male clients who always referred to him, who spoke directly to him, even though I was the director. They always spoke directly to him. And I'll never forget him one day on the side of a mountain somewhere down in Wicklow saying, "Would you ask the director, you fucking pillock? She's over there. I don't know. I take the pictures. She's got the vision." And it was just an amazing moment.
Yeah.
Where, I mean, I'm forever grateful to Peter for that. And he, you know, so you have that mix of people. Mostly my colleagues, my male colleagues, the ones who I was working with, technicians, directors, writers, I would have found them all great, actually. That wasn't where the issues lay. They lay with the people generally with the money, actually, or in the kind of positions of power in terms of, you know, being the client who's buying the product. Mm. So that would have been where problems lay. I mean, I'm so happy to see that we are no longer trying to work our way around those things. And I'm so thrilled from work that other women have done. That means that, you know, my kids hopefully won't, you know, I've quite, you know, young enough kids. I'm an older mom. And I'm just so glad that they won't have the acceptance. You can see it already. They're only just 12 and you can see it already. They don't accept any nonsense about, you know, boys being better than girls or getting preferential treatment or anything like that. They just don't accept it. Whereas I think in the 80s, you just kind of went, well, that's just par for the course. Mm. You know, someone drops the hand on you. It was who's a senior guy and some whatever. And you just kind of go, oh, how do we avoid this?
Yeah, but it was learned institutional bias often against yourself. You know, you were brought up to accept that things were the way they were. So it actually, I think it's much harder for people of an older vintage in today's world to unpick some of what has been learned from such a young age as the fabric of society, whereas somebody who comes along as 10 years old can call it out immediately as being ridiculous.
Yeah. I had a really strong feminist mom, so, you know, she wouldn't have taken any nonsense. But, you know, again, I could see she was paid less than any other guy. You know, she worked. She was predominantly a single mom. My father had left the family home, but I knew she was paid less. She knew she was paid less, you know, so it was, I mean, it's kind of an acceptance, but not really. Like, you knew it was wrong, but you just worked your way around it. That was my experience anyway, in the 80s.
The workaround. Well, Sarah, I mean, you were an executive theatre producer from a pretty early stage in your career. What did it take for you to reach that level and how tricky was it?
Well, I was very lucky to start working with the Corn Exchange pretty much straight after I did an MA in Cultural Policy and Arts Management, and I'd done a degree in communications in DCU before that. So working with Annie Ryan, who's really visionary, really talented director, and she always had great international ambitions as well. So was that international exchange and working with lots of different people. And we were very ambitious as a startup company as well. And I've always enjoyed working with startups and figuring things out. How are we going to do it? What's our ethos? What do we want to achieve? And we worked with a lot of festivals internationally as well and toured around the world. So, you know, it was a real learning curve. I didn't know stage left from stage right when I started working in theatre. But I really enjoyed that of working with lots of different artists to make sure that we could put on new. And we did a lot of original work as well. So that stood me in good stead going into festivals then with Dublin Fringe Festival and Dublin Theatre Festival. And I think that's pretty much the same as what I do today at Science Gallery International. It's all about bringing people together and solving problems and learning about processes and systems and making sure things work.
Mm. Well, you were one of the lead organisers of the Waking the Feminist movement in 2015, which was so important institutionally and culturally. How did you get involved and what was the impetus to get involved?
Well, I'd worked for many years in theatre, as we've just been talking about, but I just started working with Science Gallery International, and I knew Leanne Bell, and I saw her tweets and the exchange with Fiacc MacAneill, the director of the Abbey at the time.
Yeah, and this was actually, just to mention for people who wouldn't be familiar with it, there was a comment that Fiacc MacAneill made, them's the breaks, in relation to a suite of programming that he had, or that the Abbey had, which featured very, very few women. And the presumption, I guess, was that simply that women were not writing for the stage of the Abbey because they were not good enough. And that was, I think it hit a nerve. It really hit a nerve.
Yeah. And there's so, like in TV and film, there's a lot of women working in it, and a lot of powerful women, a lot who were very successful internationally. We all knew there was a problem. I'd certainly seen it over the years, and I think we'd all just had enough. And it was just that moment of them's the breaks and going, oh, here now, come on, we know what the problem is. And bringing kind of my governance head to it and thinking about strategy and policy, I knew that it had to be at that level. It had to be at the level of the boards. So I wrote the objectives for the movement and got in touch with Leanne. And so many women came together, and we worked incredibly fast, incredibly hard. There was no ego involved. It was just like, what do we need to do? Let's get it done. And we spent a year then working on a campaign to change it. And I can say that it did make a huge change, even just focusing on those small things like governance and policy and training. That has made a huge change over the last 6 years. Is it enough? No, it's not good enough. We're still a long way from equality in all industries. But if you make a change in one industry, then the idea is that that can be a catalyst for others, and particularly in an industry that represents people to ourselves and tells stories about ourselves. It's incredibly important that women and people have access to different stories about women. I think there's still a lot of change to be done in that regard. While the numbers have improved, the stories that we're telling about women have not.
Mm. Why do you think it was at that particular moment that women were able to band together? Because for me, it seemed like it was a confluence of different factors. For example, social media played a big role, because it's so easy for one woman to say, I didn't get my production on at this theatre because I am not good enough. And they walk away from it. Whereas if you see that there are 100 plays and 98 of them are by men, then you can understand that there is perhaps an institutional, perhaps completely unconscious, but an institutional bias nonetheless. And at that point in 2015, do you think it was easier for more women to say, hang on a minute, think about this?
Yeah, I mean, remember, it was post marriage equality at that stage in 2015, which had a huge impact, and people starting to tell their stories. Social media was a mess. Like, I had to be dragged onto Twitter. I'm not a natural on it at all. But the massive outpouring and the sharing of stories. And then we did an event which sold out, and we had 30 women on stage giving testimony of all sorts of
descriptions. I was there, it was amazing.
And I think that blew it out of the water. It took the notion that women are to blame for their own circumstances, and it showed that it was the system that was at fault, that there was a lot of unconscious bias. Not like a personal, I suppose, that anyone programming was personally against women, but we were all part of a system that we didn't recognise how patriarchal it still was, because we think of ourselves in the arts as very liberal and very egalitarian. And we're not. And that's very difficult. And I think it's still difficult for people to question their own biases. But certainly the sharing of stories has been so important, whether it's been in the marriage campaign, Waking the Feminists, or the abortion campaign after that. Social media had a huge impact on that as well. I think social media has become much more difficult in the last couple of years as well. There's a lot more attack. It's not really a safe space for people anymore. But we found each other, and then we got together and we told our stories, and then there was no going back.
Mm. Well, one of the difficult aspects of production, and I think this probably did play a part in the Abbey Theatre's history as well, is that often in order to have more female playwrights on the stage, you need to nurture them, develop them, bring them from small plays to very, very big plays, and with no history of that for a very long time, although I know it's changed now, it was difficult to reach out the hand to lift women up because it takes time. from a production perspective, it takes enormous time. And one of the things I've learned in radio production over the years, I worked in radio for a long time producing, and it was always harder to get a woman to say yes to being on air. It was always harder to get a woman to agree to be your guest on a show. And so you nearly had to make 4 phone calls for every one that you would make to a man. And for people in maybe cash-strapped or time-strapped organisations, sometimes they didn't budget the time that it was going to take to get to an equal situation. So, Linda, I wonder if that's something that has often been an issue for you in productions over the years.
Yeah, I mean, I think we've got a lot of issues in production, particularly in the kind of independent sector. There's nothing certain there. So you're always, you know, looking for the next gig. You're always trying to find the money for X, Y and Z. There's no certainty. And I think that's a huge issue. And I know I'm slightly not answering your question, but it's, I suppose I would like to say, I think it's a huge issue around women in terms of maternity leave and those type of things. I think that is a massive problem. Specifically in, I'm sure it is in other areas as well, but specifically in the independent television sector. I mean, how do you go and have your kids and still have the same work that you had before? It's really tough because there's the small companies who are maybe doing one or two productions. They can't manage that. They can't pay reasonable maternity leave. They don't know what to do with it. They're barely surviving themselves. And yes, there is that thing of how do you get the time to do anything? And then kind of more back to what you were talking about as well. You know, you ring one man for 4 women. I mean, that's, I don't mean any offence to anyone, particularly not you. I don't enjoy doing this type of thing. But I think, and I suspect Sarah probably doesn't either, but I think it's incredibly important.
I'm editing that part out.
Don't. But it is really important to do it. You know, it is really important to have our voices heard and to speak sometimes on behalf of other people or on behalf of ourselves. So there's a huge amount, like Waking the Feminists was, you know, Bula Boss, this a fantastic movement and brilliantly, I thought, received actually, you know, and it was loud and it was proud and it was wonderful. There's change to come, loads of it. But I think unless you have, I suppose, regulation, you know, within industries that are not that certain, that's problematic. And, you know, I can see it. I can see my colleagues dropping off because they want to have a family. And who's going to do the primary amount of childcare? It still is very, very often the female of that family unit.
Well, you mentioned, I mean, you have kids yourself and you've a huge leadership role. So how difficult has it been to reconcile for you personally?
Well, I have a wife. And so we're two women functioning our household. So, you know, Fergus has a wife and I have a wife. So we are two women functioning our household with very particular view of how that should be done. So it is challenging for sure. But like there's a major unity. And I'm not saying there isn't unity in other types of relationships. There are, of course. But it is harder. It's a societal shift. It's a huge shift. It's very different. So for us, yes, it's challenging, but it's not that challenging, actually. You know, I waited a long time to have my kids. I knew earlier it was either kids or career. So I waited very late, way too late, actually, you know, in terms of we could have had the chance of not having children, if you know what I mean.
Do you mind me asking how old you were when you had your kids?
I was in my just over my mid-40s. So, you know, I was 45 or 46, I think, when they were born. Ferg is their birth mom. But, you know, that's very chancy. You know, I'd be encouraging. You see, on one hand, I want to encourage my nieces, you know, don't wait too long, you know, if they want to have children. But on the other hand, I want them to have good, fine careers that I've had. I've had a great career and I love my career. But it was really touch and go about whether I could maintain my career and have a family.
Yeah. And we see all these new developments, like companies, a lot of the social media companies actually taking the decision to allow their female employees to go and freeze their eggs and have different initiatives designed to help women in the workplace. What do you think of that?
I think it'd be much better focusing on childcare at a society level than
doing, like, IVF is very expensive, you know, been through it myself. And there's no guarantees when you freeze your eggs. And why has that onus been put on women solely rather than thinking about families? Like, we need families, we need children for society, and they should be supported. And it should be a cost to society. And great that companies are doing that, but if they're not providing the full suite of childcare and maternity care and good roads back into work for women who need to take time off. And we need to look at fathers taking a much bigger role in looking after their kids, and for it to be much more normal for men to take that time off work as well.
Mm. I completely agree.
Totally
with Sarah.
Agree. Yeah.
I think this thing of absolutely, if someone wants to freeze their eggs and wants to do things in that way, really, but women should be facilitated to have children at an age that they choose to have children, and to keep their career and progress in their career. So that is about childcare, maternity leave. It's about flexibility.
Mm. As time wore on, and obviously you came into your position as CEO, was there a moment when you thought to yourself, hang on a minute, I have great power here, not only in terms of the company and the immediate situation that I'm in, but also in terms of affecting how the people who watch your programs view the world? So there's great philosophical possibilities. Did that start to come to the fore in terms of you taking your outlook and
putting it into our programs?
Yeah.
And yeah, that's been going on a long time. And I see it in my own colleagues now as well. You know, I think we do really well, like, say, in something like First Dates. I mean, you look at that and kind of go, oh, that's a lovely show. There's so much thought and effort put into the diversity of that show and the kindness. I mean, it would be very hard to see the amount of energy and thought that goes in from the entire team and from me, obviously. You know, so we are very conscious in our programming how we treat people, how we portray people, how we see people who should be seen. You know, so we're very, very conscious of that. And so, you know, we don't always get it right. And occasionally you get it wrong and you kind of feel really awful about something. But, you know, you just amend it, you fix it, you don't do that wrong the next time. You have you learn more about that type of person or that type of person. And I'll say again, I mean, this is probably more in the last decade or so, I find kindness just really important. And I find kindness on television as well, like, just really important, because I suppose with social media, there's a lot of unkindness, there's a lot of nastiness. So I kind of enjoy. That's not to say we can't be edgy or funny or fun, or Dermot can't be having a row with someone. Of course he can. But it is that thing of just the portrayal of people, and not to be, I suppose, it's not the job of people in either television or on stage or in the jobs we do to take the piss out of people. That is not what we should be doing.
No, it's just Dermot that you get to do that with. Why is he in the bath all the time?
Who loves bats? That's all I can say about that.
And Sarah, similarly to Linda, did you feel that philosophically you were in a position to put your stamp on Ireland through your work, and actually the thoughts that you had about feminism, about equality, that there was a way to feed it into the cultural framework via your own job? I mean, that must be very satisfying in a way, to think I can influence, I can maybe not change people's minds, but at least ask them to think about it.
Look, what we do is very small in a way, and you want to have impact with your work, no matter how small. It all matters. It's not life and death, but it does have an impact, and that impact can be subtle. But the kind of change that we're looking for when we're trying to build an equal society and a more representative, inclusive society is about long-term change. And stories have such a part of that. So if we grow up in a society that is all about patriarchal stories and feeding boys and men their heroes breakfast, dinner and tea, whereas women have to constantly go searching for those heroes and for those stories. And it's great to see so many books coming out for young girls now that are telling them stories in different ways. It's absolutely fantastic. So much has changed. But yes, it definitely, when I started to really think about the impact that theatre could have beyond us doing our plays from week to week or month to month, it was like, oh God, there's a much bigger game at play here. And there's something very, very exciting about being part of that change that is thinking about, like, I'm in my mid-40s. And unfortunately, to get equality, you have to think of 20, 40, 60 years. It's not a fast change. Like, change is very, very slow. And it takes a lot of subtle, subtle changes over time. There are still things that may not be challenging for us at our age, but are challenging for that young gay person or young trans person who is growing up today in Mayo. So I think it's still challenging being gay and being a feminist, because the work isn't done.
What have you learned about people through your decades of work?
Oh, most people just want to have a happy life and get on with it. You know, lots of people don't even think about these things day to day. They're just drifting through life oblivious. But actually, you know, from my work in politics, people are very kind and want the best for their neighbours and for their society. Just most people just don't know how to get there. And we prioritise often the wrong things in society and certainly at a political level. But when you get down to it and really talk to people, we've so much more in common than we don't. There's a lot of fear and there's a lot of casual sexism, casual homophobia still out there.
And speaking of politics, obviously, with Soc Dems, what are your aspirations now?
Well, I've run 3 elections in the last 3 years. I'd like to have a break, certainly this year. It's a lot. It's a lot of stress, but it's actually fantastic to see so many women get involved in politics. And I think that's come out of the campaigns over the last few years. I think the political system will take a lot longer to change than I would like. But certainly I love running. It's a great opportunity to get out there.
I don't know how you love running. It just seems like...
But it's the same as theatre, same as science galleries, going out and talking to people and just being organised. But it is expensive.
Do you not feel vulnerable?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, but like, you know, if I got over that with Waking the Feminist and doing all the media stuff and putting myself on stage when I was strictly behind the stage, it's like, okay, if I've done this and I went through all of the criteria with Women for Election, like the 5 C's that they talk about, it's like, okay, I don't have the childcare issues. I have some cash. I have some confidence. I have some training. I can go ahead and do it. Yeah. I was very lucky to find in the Social Democrats a party that is very feminist and very equitable. I would have never seen a place for me as a gay and as a woman in my younger life, although I would have been interested in politics from a young age. I wouldn't have seen that except with the change with marriage equality and that change in society. So again, a change in one area can impact in others. But like, I would encourage many more women to get involved in politics. But the system is still not friendly for women.
Do you think you have to work twice as hard to get to half the distance?
Absolutely. Again, it's a case of that change comes very, very slow and then very fast. We don't have anywhere near a representative parliament in our country, and yet we have absolutely fantastic women. So we have to work doubly hard. But the system also has to meet us halfway.
Mm. Well, Linda, actually, speaking of kind of ambitions and aspirations, I wanted to mention the 34th, the documentary that you co-directed on marriage equality. Can you tell me a little bit about the impetus to bring that to the screens and again about people's reaction to it? You know, I was asking Sarah, you know, what have you learned about people? What did you learn about people making and showing that documentary?
I'm not entirely sure what I learned about people, but I know that it was an incredibly stressful time making that particular documentary. It originally started out to be essentially archiving what the group had done, what the group of marriage equality had done. But, you know, nothing is ever that simple. And I think many people in the LGBTQ plus community would have liked to have seen it broader. You know, the history of our kind of entire community. So I wasn't doing that, and I was never going to try and do that. I mean, it was almost, it was barely funded, and then it was self-funded, and, you know, it was, so I wasn't even going to try and do that. I just wanted, it was really started out as a kind of a thing, we need to archive what marriage equality has done, or what the group marriage equality had done. And I was a part of that group. I had, myself and Ferga had sat at that table, at that board for many, many years, long before it became a thing that everyone was moving towards marriage equality. So they were some kind of tough times. But so it was really difficult making it. I was glad I made it. You know, it ended up being much bigger than I expected. It ended up being a feature. It ended up on Netflix. It ended up, you know, lots of things. So, but it's very hard, you know, as a program maker, you're always trying to slightly, you want to remove yourself in some ways to try and make sure you are just, you are fair and just, and especially when you're looking at sides of a thing. And there are many sides to marriage equality. But you also are in there. You can't help yourself. That's also part of what you do. You're in there and you're out here. So it's very, very challenging to do those things. So, yeah, so I found it a really, really difficult process. Now, Vanessa and I, it was brilliant. Vanessa, you know, had been working around COCO at the time, and I'd asked her to become involved. And then Cúain MacNeill, who was the editor, was like a third director, really. It was really the three of us kind of made that. And then, of course, we had such articulate people who were able to talk about marriage equality in a way. And it was, you know, it ended up being incredibly moving because, of course, Anne-Louise died during, while we were making it, and, you know, we would have been very good friends. So there were lots of challenges, yeah.
Yeah, and it was a documentation of the relationship between Catherine Zappone and Anne-Louise Gilligan, and the power of that was, I suppose, even further evoked by the loss.
Completely. And, you know, it had, you know, so you go and you're kind of archiving, but you're going, but, you know, there has to be something else to it. It needs a heart. It needs a centre. And they were the obvious kind of centre of that, their relationship, because that is how they presented themselves in terms of the marriage equality campaign. They talked about love all the time. You know, they really educated me in ways. You know, I was, as a younger woman, you know, it was all about rights, you know. And they were kind of, but it's about love. And I'm going, oh, it's about rights. So, and, you know, I still think it's about rights. But I do think, obviously, the love element of that was, it's, as Sarah is saying, the telling of stories is probably the most important thing around achieving equality, and recognising, understanding, embracing diversity.
Yeah. Well, I won't keep you too much longer. I really appreciate the time. But I did want to ask, do you think things are better now? Like that old slogan, was it Fianna Fáil? A lot done, more to do. What is your take on the Ireland of now?
There's a lot that's better. But then I think globally there's a lot that's worse. So I think we're in a really difficult situation globally. You know, when my kids were born, I kind of thought, oh, this is a great world they're coming into, and we're achieving equality, and, you know, they won't be growing up in a homophobic world, and, you know, it'll just all be so much better. And then we have climate change, then we have the war, then we have the pandemic. And we have social media, which has its good and bad bits. And, you know, as parents, you're always trying to keep your kids off that stuff. And so far we have done. But I think it's a really challenging world, actually. So in terms of Ireland, yes, I think we are a more embracing, easier to live in place. Certainly for me, I find that. But in terms of the world, I think globally we're in, well, obviously we are, we're in a very, very difficult position at the moment. Mm. And it's very tough on young people. I think it's really tough on them.
Yeah, yeah. Well, what advice would you give to young people at the moment who are starting out in either theatre or production, television, the creative industries? Sarah?
I would say be tenacious, believe in yourself, be ambitious, but definitely be decent, be kind. You know, it's a long career. You have to be good to people. When we were over at the Lily Awards, there's a writer and actor called Danai Gurira, and she gave this amazing advice to young female writers, and she said, go where you are loved and get it done. You still have got to do the work, so get it done.
The idea of get it done, are you a fan of the notion, don't allow the good be the enemy, don't allow the great to be the enemy of the good? That idea that it's better to get it done than to have it be perfect.
Oh, yeah. Oh, and particularly in television, it's there and it's gone every week. You know, you don't have the time to kind of sit on it forever. You know, you just have to, you know, do as good as you can and get it done. The one thing I would add, though, I think Sarah's, you know, what advice is brilliant for young people, but for young women in particular. And I was flawed in this myself, value yourself.
Mm.
And I mean monetary. Mm-hmm. Value yourself.
It's all right.
Young women, absolutely value yourself. Do not undersell yourself, either in terms of saying what you can and can't do, but also in terms of monetary value. I would say that is a mistake that I think young women are kind of pushed into doing it like that. But don't, I would say, don't value yourself appropriately.
Mm. So important not to be afraid of money and to get to grips with that really early on in your career. Completely agree.
Mm. Well, I was about to ask what you wish you'd known earlier in your career, Sarah.
Probably about speaking up more. And I think, as Linda said, knowing your own value. Yeah. It's not something I really understood, or the power of my own voice, in my earlier career.
Mm. Well, I mean, as I was mentioning in the introduction, you're Associate Director of Science Gallery International, and the Dublin Gallery is closed, but there are many other galleries. So what are you working on at the moment? What are you excited about?
Well, we're looking forward to Hooked opening in Atlanta in the next few months. The London Gallery with King's College London will be reopening in June. Next year, we hope we'll have 4, if not 5, galleries open. We're hopeful that Dublin can reopen, that we can work that out with Trinity and the government in the next few months. And then we'll be going to Melbourne. They have a great exhibition about mental health, which is so important for young people at the moment. And that'll be touring to Singapore.
Do you get to go to all these places?
I get to go to a lot of them. Yes, that's certainly something I'm looking forward to post-pandemic, to a little bit more travel.
Okay, well, I am jealous. Linda, Dermot in a bath, Dermot in a swimming pool.
Wash your mouth out. I've never been in a bath with Dermot.
What are the plans for cocoa content?
Okay, so we've got all our renewable series moving forward. We're running into another series of First Dates. We'll be doing another series of Room to Improve, Incredible Homes, all of those sorts of things, Home Rescue. We're working on a really interesting documentary series that I can't say too much about it at the moment, but it's about the Irish, and I'm just really hopeful that looks like it's going to get moving at the moment as well. And we're always developing new stuff as well. So yeah, so it's kind of, I think post pandemic, we're kind of just lifting ourselves up again rather than just getting through and thinking of new projects. And so it's kind of exciting at the moment. Actually, it's really good.
So it's emerging from the bunker.
Pretty much.
Yeah.
And sorry, I said post-pandemic, and I give out stink about people who say post-pandemic. Because it isn't post-pandemic, no. But you know what I mean.
Yeah, I absolutely do. And I do it myself. Well, listen, we're going to leave it there. But thank you so much, Sarah Durkin and Linda Cullen. It's been an absolute pleasure to speak to you today on How I Did It.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
How I Did It, the Business Post's Women in Leadership podcast.
Now, I'm delighted to be joined by Valeria Aquino, Integration Officer at the Immigrant Council of Ireland, who's on the line today to talk about how to embrace a more inclusive attitude in the workplace. Valeria, you are very welcome to the podcast. How are you today?
I'm fine, thank you. Thank you for the invitation. I'm very happy to be here.
Valeria, how would you define unconscious bias? Because when we talk about an inclusive workplace, really, what we are talking about is the idea of unconscious bias and how to avoid it. You deliver intercultural training for the Immigrant Council. What examples of unconscious bias have you encountered through that work?
I have, like, of course, examples like from the training we do, personal as well experience on unconscious biases, because as a migrant woman myself, like I was out there as well as a job seeker going for interviews, and you can face like different kind of experiences. For example, I can tell like about one example in particular that happened to me, that I went for an interview for a coffee shop, and it was the girl from the HR and the manager of the place. And they both were like very professional, like very, nice people, but they were really like, the tone was really professional until he asked me, where are you from? And I told him, like, I am from Brazil. And his approach with me, like his body language, the way he behaved during the interview changed completely. He was always smiling and asking me like inappropriate questions, more like personal questions. So I think when he accessed the information he had in his head about what a Brazilian woman should be treated or what is acceptable behavior for this group of people was the way he reacted towards me. And it was very uncomfortable for me.
What advice would you give to employers and managers to address those kinds of attitudes?
I think like the first thing is to really like give opportunity to your employees to access reliable information about cultural differences, like providing training and also like hiring more people from ethnic minority background, give your company opportunity to live experience with people from different cultures. So you would have the information from the source, a reliable source, people that are from the culture. Also to address like racist incidents in the company, you need to have like very clear policies and procedures on how to address the incident, which like really step by step and what to do if this happens to you. And it has to be like since the onboarding process, like your employee cannot be wondering how to do or if he or she is protected or not in her workplace. Mm-hmm. Because like we can see through our helpline as well, because I'm the coordinator for the Integrated Support Service, that people like they really have no idea how to report this to the companies. Mm-hmm. and they also don't feel comfortable doing. And so it's really like be more clear and more supportive of people that are living these experiences for them to come forward and report, and you'll be able to deal in a better way.
And one of the things I found through my decades of working, Valeria, is that I try to listen if somebody comes to me with a complaint, whether it's about any type of work that I've done, if somebody says somebody wasn't represented or that there is a problem, rather than get angry and defend the position, I try to stop and listen and really try to see if I have an unconscious bias. And do you think that's really the first port of call, to actually put aside any anger or defense of a rationale, and instead just stop and listen to people and listen to what they're saying to you?
Yes, of course. Like I think, like I said, like we already have a lot of information within ourselves that we are receiving from our sources. There are biases themselves, and so like to give really the opportunity of people to speak in those cases and really try to be like fair. And it is all about like to be equal, to give equal treatment to people and give them the opportunity to talk. So like it's a basically fairness thing. Like you mm-hmm. don't have to be too overcomplicated with your approach.
Do you think that tackling unconscious bias is enough to address discrimination?
I think it is a first step. But of course, like to deal with such a complex issue like racism and discrimination, we need a combination of actions. We need to, for example, a better legislation to hold people accountable on their actions. We need, like as I mentioned before, like very clear policies and procedures within our companies and organizations. Also, like we need a media that don't reinforce stereotypes, don't spread misinformation. So like we have a combination of things that has to be done for us to really tackle like racism and discrimination in our day to day, not just in the workplace, but everywhere.
Yeah. Well, you're doing really valuable work, and thank you for taking the time to speak to us on the podcast today. Valeria Aquino, Integration Officer at the Immigrant Council of Ireland. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
How I Did It, the Business Post's Women in Leadership podcast.
And my thanks once again to Linda Cullen, Sarah Durkin and Valeria Aquino. That is it from us for the second series of How I Did It.
Thank you so much for tuning in. And remember, you can find all of our episodes on the Business Post website. That's businesspost.ie/podcast. And you can also find us via Spotify, iTunes and many other podcast providers. And remember, while this series is drawing to a close, the Business Post Law on Trial podcast, the legal affairs podcast, is currently in full swing with its second season. So why not check it out? Just do a search for Law on Trial. My thanks also to our sponsor, Glandor, to my co-producer, Catherine Healy, and indeed to all of our guests who have appeared on the series. If you'd like to contact me at any stage, you can find me on Twitter, twitter.com/Nadina Regan. Right. Thank you again for listening. Till the next time, do take care.
How I Did It, the Business Post Women in Leadership podcast.
Sponsored by Glandor, creating space for business to grow.